weekly podcast. My name is Steve Westgarth, and I will be your host for the next half an hour. Each week I am joined by someone who is working in the mobile space for a fireside chat, and today I'm joined by Jaime Lopez, who is an iOS developer working for Simple in the Portland area of Seattle. So hi, Jaime, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Yeah, really good, thank you. Thank you very much for joining us on the Code Mobile Weekly podcast. It's very good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Fantastic. So, I mean, let's start by saying Simple. What is Simple? I understand it's something to do with banking. So what are you doing?
So Simple is a fintech company that's the portmanteau of financial and technology. We're really like a bank, but simple. That's our tagline. For your listeners who are coming from the UK, I think Monzo and Revolut and the newly launched N26 will probably give you a real sense of the kind of banking technology company we are. We're right. Very similar to them, but in the United States.
So, I mean, by reading your website at devwiththehair.com, if you haven't come across that before, you're very into user experience. That's kind of your bag of what you do. And it says that you're very into making mobile banking easier and more simple. So what gives you a passion for user experience?
It's something that I've really liked because it feels so tangible working on that end of it. Before I was an iOS developer, and I guess even before I was a web developer, I spent a lot of time in building backend and sort of enterprise-oriented things. And in this case, it was at a very large aerospace company. If you're in the UK, not that one, the other one, remember I'm in the United States. It wasn't quite as tangible and easy to say, oh, I am going into the office every day and I'm building software for a line maintenance mechanic that you'll hopefully never have to see because hopefully your airplane is in good tip-top shape. And it was rather difficult to just explain to the family members at the holidays, what do you do? Oh, I develop software for blah, blah, blah. And like, oh, you work for this company. Do you build the airplane? No, I don't build the airplanes. Do you work on the airplanes? Technically, no. My software might be on a laptop that's on board the aircraft itself, but not part of the flight control systems. And working in especially the mobile space, focusing on user experience and UI and other bits of interaction has been really nice because it's been very tangible. I can create something 1 minute and hand it over to somebody else and they can instantly see what it is I'm working on and give me feedback for that. The iterative loops are quite tighter. So that's sort of where I ended up getting a lot of the sort of creative juice and desire to work more in that user experience facing side of things. And so mobile and iOS development in particular has worked quite well for that.
Now, it says on your website you're particularly passionate about giving great experience to inexperienced smartphone users. So what is it about inexperienced users that you really like working with?
I think the fact that it is more than just for the elites or for the rather savvy, depending on who you're talking about. I worked at a startup here in the Seattle area several years ago now that was really predicated on the kind of application that everybody should be able to use. I mean, I don't know that if you were Bill Gates or Kim Kardashian, you would necessarily need to use it, but you certainly could. It was sort of a for the every person. And that raises some challenges. Granted, as the mobile space has matured, it's less and less likely that you have people who have never used a smartphone before or that this is their very first smartphone. But there is still a rather large contingent of people who may not be very technologically savvy and maybe less comfortable with things, who really want that just let me get my task done sort of thing, rather than really geeking out about the technology itself, even though that's certainly something that I do as a developer and podcaster and talking about tech.
I think you're right. I think for me, my smartphone is an extension of my left arm. It goes with me everywhere I go. But my mum, for example, she's 72, and she's still getting to grips with technology. And I know she would feel very uncomfortable about doing her banking on a mobile phone. You know, she's just about got to grips with internet banking, but it's got to be the next thing that she does. She needs to get to grips with using mobile devices to do common everyday tasks like banking. And I think she recognizes that.
Yeah, it definitely does come in all sort of flavors and things. So I'll take my parents in particular as sort of being how have they adjusted to technology. For a very long time, my mom was never really into computers and rarely used one. If she did, it was probably just to do spreadsheet type calculations for tax time, right? So when our income taxes are due. In contrast, my dad, pretty much right away was with me, you know, ripping apart the PC, the computer, and, you know, installing a rewritable CD drive, which was like the hotness back in those days, or, you know, exchanging that for a DVD drive, and that became something that we wanted to do. But it seemed like he got sort of caught in that, like, that mindset of desktop PC is perfectly fine for him. And here we come, you know, 20-some years later, and my mom is using a smartphone that has Facebook, and she's, you know, sending me stuff through Facebook Messenger and doing all sorts of more typical things you would do with technology nowadays. And my dad, in contrast, has a smartphone but uses it more like it was a feature phone or a dumb phone, mostly just for texting and for actual phone calling. And it's very strange to see that sort of weird gap, but it sort of reinforces in my mind the idea that first-time smartphone users don't necessarily even have to do with technological savviness, but perhaps on comfort level of what it is that they're likely to do. Like in my case, I think my mother would be more likely to do online banking than my dad, who would probably just go to the normal local bank branch and do his banking that way.
I think you're right, but I think it's becoming more and more apparent that banks need to become more savvy with things like mobile experiences and how they can get their users to use their technology. About a year ago, I moved banks here in the UK. I moved to a bank called HSBC, and quite soon after I moved banks, I started using their mobile app, and I realized that their user experience was so unuser-friendly and so unusable that about 3 or 4 weeks later, I actually moved banks a second time because the app simply didn't do what I wanted it to do in an easy way. I think I spent something like 3/4 of a day just trying to log on to their mobile banking app for the first time, and it was just time I didn't have to spend, and as a user, I wasn't prepared to give them that much of my time. So I guess that, you know, for somebody like yourself that's working in a new style bank that's, you know, I guess very much technology first, that's something you've really focused on.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's quite different than, you know, I've had family members who have worked as bank tellers, and they loved that human interaction. They loved knowing the same customers who'd come in, you know, every Monday, so-and-so who owns their own business comes in and they deposit a whole bunch of cash, or every Thursday, so-and-so comes and they're elderly, so they tell me about their children and their grandchildren, and they know about, you know, our family's birthdays, and they might leave gifts and things. That's quite the opposite of what I want, where I want to do my banking at 2 a.m. in the morning because I need to move, you know, cash from here to there, or I need to schedule a payment to go out, or other sorts of things where, you know, I'm much more likely to use the ATM if I use cash at all. And in fact, I'd rather just do everything digitally if possible. So it's definitely a brave new world coming out there. And I think we'll be straddling both sides of that user experience for people who are mobile first, digital first, maybe even digital only. And folks who have lived in the analog world who are less comfortable or more comfortable, depending, and sort of have to be brought along as well into doing things mobile friendly.
Yeah. And I think one of the things which really annoyed me about my HSBC incident was that when I called the bank to say I was having trouble registering, they very much blamed the problem on me. It was a problem that I was having. It was something that I was doing wrong, and I needed to follow their process and their procedure. And if I did it, you know, their way, then I would be able to do it. And I think that, you know, from a user experience point of view, that's obviously very bad. That's not something you really want to do. So I guess the question I'd say to you is, can a user ever get it wrong?
I don't know that users are always correct, but certainly it comes to my mind that if the user can't figure out what's happening, it's almost certainly my fault or our fault collectively, because we should make it so that the complexity is hidden from the user. And of course, we should have things like stability, right? Like the software should always be working, particularly when it comes to something like people's financial lives. And it's really rare. I mean, if somebody was, you know, trying to use a Jell-O mold to make a external transfer from one bank to another, all right, look, the user's wrong in that case. But if they're trying to do something completely reasonable, It's really incumbent upon us as, software development professionals to make sure that it works the first time, every time, and we are always continuously figuring out how the user experience can be much more seamless. Because I don't know about you, but even though I work in the banking industry, I don't live and breathe like, wow, I sure would like to take a look at my finances, 4 hours a day, like as if it was the Facebook news feed or Twitter's news feed. It's not really the same sort of thing. You really want to come up with your strategy for longer term planning and then short term sort of tactical planning of, oh, do I have enough money to go to the restaurant and out to the movies this weekend?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's very much intrinsically linked to that is making sure that your app or your user experience does what the user expects it to do when they expect it to do it. And a good example of that, there's a speaker who I've seen speak two or three times here in the UK called Joe Leach. He actually wrote a fantastic book called Psychology for Designers. And back in 2002, he went to Argentina and he used a cash point. And as part of that process, the machine swallowed his card. So he lost his card and he had to ring the bank up and get a new card issued. But what was interesting is he actually went back to Argentina in 2012 and exactly the same thing happened again. He lost his card a second time. And he started thinking to himself, how can this possibly be? How can I have lost my card twice on two trips to Argentina? I haven't lost it in the intervening 10 years. So something must have gone on here. And when he analysed that situation, he realised that the normal process for using a card machine is that you put in your card, you enter your PIN number, you select withdraw cash, you select the amount you want to withdraw. The card then comes out of the machine before the cash is dispensed. The cash being dispensed is the golden moment where you see that the transaction is closed. But in an Argentinian cash point, the card is actually returned after the cash is dispensed. So it's reversed those two steps. So you've got your cash, you've had your golden moment, and in both situations, he'd walked away from the cash point and the machine had therefore you swallowed his card. So in that situation, the machine hadn't done what he'd expected it to do. So I guess that's one of the challenges that you are facing on a daily basis. How do you ensure your apps always do what you expect them to do, if that makes sense?
And that brings up a sort of interesting side note in that I wonder if there are cultural differences in when cash should come out versus when the card should come out. I'm trying to think. I'm pretty sure here in the United States, it would be card comes out, then cash comes out, and then maybe a receipt if you ask to have one printed. So it'd be rather rare. It probably would confuse me. I'm almost certainly going to lose my card, apparently, if I go to Argentina, and expect that it's going to be in the opposite way, and then the machine's going to eat my card because I didn't pull it out fast enough.
Absolutely. And I think the fact you're saying that the receipt comes out at the end, and I think that's the same in the UK, the receipt is the last thing that comes out of the machine. But it's amazing how many receipts are actually left in the machine and discarded because by that point in the transaction, the user's completed, they've walked away, they've done what they wanted to do, they've achieved their goal, as it were. So it will be interesting to almost experiment with things like that and say, well, what happened, if we gave a receipt at a different point in the process, or maybe instead of giving a receipt, we emailed the receipt to the user, for example, would that be a better user experience?
Yes, and that's an interesting one to do the mobile sort of or online digital sort of first thing. And I'm really, really certain that I've seen more and more ATMs here in the United States, or at least my part of the United States, that when it comes to printing out a receipt or not, I think they have it set to no receipt as a default. So you really have to go out of your way to get that receipt printed. And presumably, if you've done that, you are more likely to remember to pull it out of the machine rather than leaving it there as a sort of privacy violating token hanging around.
Absolutely. And related to that, I was reading some of your blog posts on your website. And one of the things that I noticed was there was an article that was talking around fail faster as a developer. And essentially what you were saying in that article is that if you're testing user experiences and seeing what works really well for the user, the quicker you fail, the better it is for you as a developer because you've wasted less time and money. So what's your approach to that in your everyday working life?
Well, I think it comes at sort of varying degrees and levels. So I'll try to fail faster, on the user experience side of things, by pulling out a sketchbook, or I'm sort of partial to whiteboards, using markers, that sort of things that I can just, erase and really just started sketching out what I'm trying to do. And if I realize, oh, even in this, very simple prototype, it's not working. Well, I can tell it's not going to work in code either. And that sort of applies the same way towards, developing software as well, where I think as I've gotten further along in my career, I'm much less likely to immediately jump into code, something like Xcode or any text editor, and immediately just start hammering away writing lines of code. I think because I found that it's much faster to really think about, what's the problem in front of me? What are some possible patterns or solutions that I might come up with that maybe I've heard other people use, or maybe I've used myself in, my career? And then when I think I have a really good grasp on things, and it might include sketching out, data flows or maybe class hierarchies, maybe some interaction diagrams that I've maybe even just, put in a sketchbook or on a whiteboard or just drawn on a piece of paper randomly just to see, like, does this all fit together? And then start writing code. And I've found that 9 times out of 10, that's a much faster way to do things because it's easier to erase, let's say, like a line between two different classes than it is to change the interaction between two different classes in code. And I think going through the mental exercise of really making sure I know what I'm talking about has really helped to speed things up overall. Like, it seems slower. It seems like, oh man, like, started at 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. I've not written a single line of code. Yeah, but come tomorrow on Tuesday, I'm gonna be ready to just hammer out that particular solution versus starting writing code immediately at 8 a.m., getting to 5 p.m. with this gnarled mess that's clearly not going to work, and then being in a rather sad situation on Tuesday, scrapping it all and starting again. I think that was sort of the some of the maturity I came along of, like, look, I'm not actually paid to code, I'm paid to solve problems. So if I can solve the problem first, the code will naturally come as part of that.
And you mentioned a key word there, which is prototype. And I'm constantly surprised by how many developers I come across that don't use prototyping as part of their workflow. And it's actually such a really easy thing to do. I mean, we've done prototypes in my work using tools like Keynote, for example. If you're going to create an app, simply changing the document size so that it's the same size as your iPhone screen, you can actually make a pretty realistic app that has clickable areas that you can move around. And it gives the impression to the user that it's really, it's really working or will be how it will look once it's been developed. So what tools do you use for your own prototyping?
Let's see, beyond sketchbooks and whiteboards, I've used InVision, I've used Acture a very long time ago. I haven't really gotten into Keynote-based one, even though that does seem pretty popular. It seems like it's reasonably powerful based on a session at, I want to say it was the 2015 WWDC that I attended. I said, oh wow, that prototyping with Keynote seems really, really awesome. And I've also used some other, I don't know if they're more powerful tools, but they're certainly different tools like Facebook's Origami, or I want to say it was called Marvel. I think it got acquired by Google, and the sad state of things is that a lot of these do end up getting acquired. So the current sort of favorite for me and our design team is InVision, which is really good at not only creating the clickable prototypes, but also in sharing and amongst the group or the team, and having a pretty good record of conversations about the designs as it's been iterated on. But sometimes I've also used stuff like, I think it's called prototyping on paper. I apologize. I think it's called Pop. Maybe it turned into Marvel. It's an app for the iPhone that you can take pictures of stuff. So you might take screenshots from, other apps, and you can mark them up. Or in my case, I will take pictures of screens that I've drawn in my sketchbook, and then you can show those photos as if it was the app's sort of wireframe, and you can make clickable or tappable regions and sort of get a sense of the flow. So it's sort of like the next step after doing the sketchbook sort of framing to see, oh, okay, how would this actually work as a user interaction when this thing slides into the left or maybe pops up from the bottom and that sort of thing.
Cool. And once you have your prototype, Do you have any particular methodology you use to validate those prototypes with your users? What's your approach to getting your users involved in testing those prototypes?
Well, here at Simple, we actually are fortunate enough to have a user research team. So a lot of times that stuff will get handed off or perhaps polished by a designer who does more of the visual aspect of that. You know, somebody who's a little bit better than I am at doing that sort of thing. And that's what we'll end up using to get validation that we're even sort of on the right track. And maybe even some improvements for, oh, okay, well, the user knew what was going on here, but they struggled a little bit to get to that point. So let's see if we can make this even more obvious or eliminate steps where possible.
I actually read a book just a few weeks ago called Sprint, Solve Big Problems and Test New Ideas in Just 5 Days, by a guy called Jake Knapp, who works for Google Ventures. And they were talking around how they have a 5-day process by which they come together, come up with lots of different ideas, develop one prototype, and then bring a group of users in together to test that prototype. So that you're within that 5-day period with a very small amount of investment, I guess, they can start to really validate their ideas and see if those ideas are going to work in the real world. And I guess that's something that, as an indie developer, that would be relatively inexpensive, you know, for me to set up potentially. And you know, you don't necessarily have to have a large user experience team, which obviously would be fantastic for us all to have. But I guess, you know, a lot of people are working out there in the space where that sort of resource simply isn't available for them.
Yes, and I think one of the interesting things that I read about, I want to say it was Jacob Nielsen's group did research, and they figured out that it takes something like 5 people to do user research with, where you'll get about 80% of, you know, all the various bits of feedback you were ever going to get if you ran it with an infinite number of people. And somewhere around 15 individuals in the user research study is where you get about 95%. So it really doesn't take a lot. I know there are things out there like usertesting.com and a few other competitors that allow you to do the rather, you know, large scale sort of Amazon Mechanical Turk style, have 1 million people look at this and we'll look at the stats. But they found that I mean, you could do that, right? If you have the, you know, bankroll of an Uber or a Google, sure, by all means. But for indie developers, if you were to just try to find 5 people, even just randomly on the streets, at a coffee shop or something, sometimes your friends and family, although that gets a little dicey because they're sort of inclined to be nice to you, and you really want somebody who has, you know, no skin in the game whatsoever to give you true and honest feedback. It's not as difficult to do or as expensive to do as I think a lot of people believe it to be, which is kind of interesting to me.
One of the things that was said in the book I was just referencing there is that, you know, simply by offering a small reward to users, to people to come along and participate in your testing, is more than enough to get most people to come and get involved. I mean, I guess if you were going to do some guerrilla usability testing, you might go into a Starbucks and you're simply offered to buy somebody a coffee. But actually, you know, putting up a 20 or 30 pound Amazon voucher or something like that, you know, isn't a huge amount of money to invest, you know, across, you know, maybe 4 or 5 users, as you suggest. And I guess, you know, most people will, you know, give a half an hour of their time, you know, in return for 20 or 30 pounds.
But less than a few $100, you'll have at least one round of feasibility on what you're trying to do. And I think that's a huge savings versus just, you know, think about spending weeks or months or years on something and you think it's great, and maybe it would be great, but maybe just for you and not for the huge audience that you were hoping it would apply for.
And I think one of the problems that we have certainly in the place where I work here in the UK is often you have clients who come in, you know, we do a lot of client work, and clients don't really understand the benefits of really looking at UX and testing out your different ways of doing things, and is this the right way to go about doing it. Now, I guess obviously in your work in Simple, your company is very much invested in getting the best user experience that you possibly can. But if you haven't got a company or a client that is, you're really convinced that they need to do this sort of testing, how do you convince clients that investment in UX is a good spend and not actually a waste of money?
I feel like there are two different kinds of answers that I could give. One, somewhat more pragmatic, and another a little bit more bold. So I think probably the bold answer, since it's the shorter one, is should that even be part of the discussion, or should it just be part of your process. So I take an example from other professionals. If I go into the doctor because I'm sick and they say, all right, well, I need to check your temperature. I need to take a look at your throat because you've been complaining about a cold. I need to take a look at your eyes and your ears. I'm really not going to push back on that much, if at all, unless it's something wildly crazy, like, oh, I'm complaining of a head cold and they're wanting to check my elbow. I might say, well, okay, what does the elbow have to do with things? But as long as it's sort of within reason of expectation, I sort of roll with it. And I think it's something that we as professionals probably should push a little harder on, that writing tests is critical and important, even if the customer doesn't believe that it's the sort of thing they want to pay for. And doing usability and user experience work is most likely going to be valuable for them, even if they don't feel like it's the sort of thing they want to pay for. So that's sort of the bold and somewhat more snarky look at it. Perhaps the more pragmatic look of it is to say, well, let's explore sort of what those costs would be. So you're right in that something that's much more consumer facing, like simple, it has to completely be about the user experience, because our users are the people who are our customers as well. As opposed to, certainly I've lived this life before, where in enterprise or business to business sort of context, the people you're contracting with and who are paying the bills, so to speak, they're not necessarily the ones who are going to use the software, right? I mean, everybody's complained about enterprise software, like, wow, I'm sure it convinced an executive somewhere that this is great. But for me, as somebody who's using this every day, this stinks. And it's costing us money because this is taking me 10 minutes more every day. And there are 100 of us just like me. And just think about all that money that's being spent. So I think coming at it from the cost perspective of, all right, well, we could go with whatever we come up with and not have a usability work or user experience work, but how much does it cost you when things go wrong and somebody contacts your customer support? Are you in legal violation of any sort of way if the user is completely confused about what is happening? I think those are the sorts of questions of turning it into dollars and cents that will make it easier to, as a selling point.
And I think that when you're looking at things like that, if you can really sell that argument, it clearly makes for a better product. I was having a conversation with one of our developers just the other day, and we were talking around introducing test-driven development, something we don't do in the company that I currently work in at the moment. And they were saying that it was much more costly to do test-driven development because, it takes longer, you've got more time more time up front invested in doing that. And the point I was making is that, it's much better because, in the long term, you have fewer bugs in your app. And it's exactly the same, I guess, with user experience, that if you say, yes, we've invested this time up front to make sure the user experience is right, but that means we've only got to write the app once. And if we subsequently discover that users are finding something confusing or something isn't working the way that's intuitive to them, it's obviously a lot more costly to have to change the app further down the line, especially if you're doing that upfront work with simple prototypes, as we were talking about earlier.
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the things that I've certainly been a champion of is collaboration when it comes to doing this sort of problem solving. I don't think that it's the sort of thing where we can just sort of have people in silos, like, all right, well, the business folks came up with this, and then they handed things off to designers who designed it, and then that gets handed off to developers who develop it, and so on and so forth. That's not really realistic. If that was ever actually done in the industry before, it really shouldn't be done now. I think we've got so much more experience at the pros of collaboration and the cons of doing things in silos, where it's like, all right, let's work on this together. And I do think we have to be mindful of sort of people's comfort level. I happen to be a developer who's very much, as we've been talking about today, very much interested in the user experience side of things. So I prefer being sort of out in front of things. So I would absolutely love to be sketching things together on a whiteboard with a designer, and even better if the product manager is there as well. With that said, that's not always feasible, because sometimes I've worked with folks who don't really feel that way. They say, I kind of more of a, I'm going to go to the library, quietly come up with at least some proposals, and then bring them to the development team. That's fine too. And certainly there are developers I've worked with who do not like any uncertainty whatsoever. Like they're absolute professionals at you get all the bowling pins lined up for them, and they're going to bowl a strike every time. By golly, like they need all those bowling pins to be set up the way that they'd like them to be. And I think a lot of the conflict we end up with between the design and development, and maybe in sometimes the business side of the house, is related to people not being sort of on the same page with how those collaboration points are going to happen.
And I think that's one of your areas of interest, isn't it? It's that conflict between designers and developers. I mean, how have you found you're able to manage that conflict in your own experience?
Sometimes better and sometimes worse in my experience. I've had certainly some learning experiences where I can think of one designer in particular who, strangely enough, we would always come up with the same solution. We'd had the same beliefs about what was happening, but the way in which we came to that conclusion was by completely different roads and methods, which cause all sorts of conflict between us. Or we spend half an hour to an hour, vehemently arguing or debating about something, only to realize, wait a minute, are we arguing the same point? It sounds like a different point, but it's actually the same point, isn't it? So I've learned to be a little bit more, I guess, careful in how I'm approaching things and trying to understand, hey, like, where are you coming from on this one? Help me understand, because if you elaborate this, maybe I'll get that connection I'm not quite getting now. And that's helped tons, because I've certainly had the both sides of the same coin where I've been able to help the designer by in some cases expanding what was possible because they thought, oh, this is really difficult to do, so let me go in a different direction. And I've said, no, that's actually pretty easy. The operating system makes that super simple to do. And in fact, if you have a solution that does that, let's go with that route. And I've had the other side as well, where a designer said, oh, well, this should be not that hard, right? I said, no, absolutely not. That will take months to do. Is it really critical to the design? If it's not, let's not do that, please, because we will spend an awful lot working against the operating system and how it tends to do things. So I think it's just useful to have the skills working in concert with each other to make sure that, where compromises need to be made, let's make them, and where we can find opportunities, even better, let's find them together.
And that actually links to one of my favorite articles on your website, actually, because you mentioned in one of the articles that you'd had a there was a conflict in an app you were working on at some stage, where you had a chat feature, I think, and you were saying that users were using this particular feature in a way that wasn't desirable. You didn't want them to use it in that particular way, and some developers have been arguing they wanted to basically put a message on the app to tell the users they were doing it wrong and they should do it a different way, and you were having that argument. I think did you say you'd solved that? I think this is a fantastic quote by you're suggesting to the developers that if you went to a restaurant and there was a sign which said please don't poop on the tables, would you eat at that restaurant again? I just thought that was a brilliant way to sum up, how those sorts of conversations can go between designers and developers and potentially can come to a conclusion that everyone can understand.
Right. Yeah, that's bringing back some memories for sure. I'm taking a look at that right now. This is an audio medium, so the people driving at home can't see this, but hopefully we have that in the show notes or something.
Yeah, we'll
Because
put a link.
I'm rather proud of the vector diagram that I made of this symbol of the "Please don't poop on the tables" sign that would certainly dissuade me from going to any restaurant that had that in front, because I would think, okay, that's not a reasonable thing to for somebody to do. I certainly wouldn't want somebody to do it, but if that's the sort of clientele they have here, maybe this isn't the restaurant for me.
Absolutely. So just to really round off our conversation. I guess what I really want to touch on is what makes a great user experience. Maybe is there a particular user experience you think is the best experience you've ever had? How do you bottle that and and give every app a great user experience? I guess it's a very difficult question to ask, but what would be your advice to developers?
I think there's a few different things that people can do. I think one is to be shameless about copying things from other areas that have done it rather well. So if you have an example of an onboarding experience that you think Lyft does rather well, or you think that Twitter does rather well, I'm not saying, blindly copy what they've got and just put your branding on it and walk away and go have lunch. You're done in 15 minutes. That's not what I mean by shamelessly stealing what they've got there, but using that as the starting point where, if nothing else, it's at least good inspiration and you can analyze, well, what are the pros and cons of their approach? And you're not starting with that sort of a green field. That'll help a lot because certainly for the larger companies that I just mentioned there, they have ginormous teams of designers and developers all working, all that sort of thing. And I may not always necessarily agree with some of the design decisions they make, but odds are pretty good that they've thought long and hard on how to do that at scale, and they've probably gone through a lot of the research around that. The other bit I would say is to, and I don't know if this turn of phrase sort of makes its way across the pond rather well, but here in the United States, something that is rather popular to say is to eat your own dog food. And I don't know who started saying it. It's been attributed to many different companies. I think Microsoft here in the Seattle area is one that I've heard as being the originator. Don't know if that's true, but nevertheless, the idea being that if you are a dog food company, you can prove that your dog food is superior by eating your own product, in this case, the dog food. And yep, it is in fact 10% beefier than it was last time. And I'm a strong believer in that from the software development standpoint, where I think it's really incumbent on us, where possible, to use our own software. Sometimes that can cause blind spots because we become sort of super professionals at our own software. So there are caveats to that. But I think if you're not using your own software, it'll be rather difficult to get a good sense for, well, is this really a great user experience or not? Particularly if it's not the sort of thing that you're using very often. So if you can use it multiple times a day, every day, and really get a sense for, oh, I see the flaw here. When I have to do this only once a day, not a big deal. When I have to do this task 10 times in an hour, boy, oh boy, there must be a better way to do this. I think that's where you end up finding your opportunities to make the user experience, magical.
Some of our listeners might have been listening to this and have been inspired by some of the ideas we've been talking around and some of the work you've been doing. So if they want to find out more about you, where can they find that information out?
There are multiple avenues. If they want to contact me somewhat more directly, I'm on Twitter as @devwithahair. You mentioned my blog, devwithahair.com. I also have been co-hosting a weekly podcast called More Than Just Code for the last about 4 years. So there's tons of content there and new content coming out every week related to mobile development in particular. I definitely bring a lot of the user experience sort of discussion to the forefront, and the other co-hosts bring their own sort of take on things as well. So mtjc.fm, I'm sure your favorite podcatcher or podcast app will be able to find that rather simply. Apple Podcasts, if you're listening to this podcast, I imagine it's probably a pretty good choice for you.
Fantastic. And of course, you're coming to speak at Code Mobile for us next April, which is very exciting news.
Indeed. Not necessarily about user experience, given our conversation today, but something related to server-side Swift and IBM Watson and visual recognition and all sorts of fun things that I think people will enjoy, or hopefully they'll enjoy. I've certainly had a rather good experience showing it off to people, and they've liked it. So I really, really hope that the attendees at Code Mobile will love it as well.
We can't wait to have you there, Jaime. It'll be really good fun, I think. So thank you very much for joining me for a fireside chat tonight. It's been fascinating listening to some of your work you're doing at Simple, and some of your ideas about user experience. I hope you've had fun chatting today. It's been great to have you on board. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
You've been listening to the Code Mobile Weekly Podcast. If you want to reach out to us, you can get us at Code Mobile UK on Twitter. It'd be great to hear from you. If you know of anybody who maybe wants to come along and have a fireside chat with me, it's a weekly podcast, comes out every Sunday. Would love you to get in touch. Just drop us a tweet at Code Mobile UK. And obviously check out codemobile.co.uk to find out more about Code Mobile and what we're doing. But thanks very much for listening, And we'll talk to you again next week.